you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I sure hope you've had a good start to your day. We, of course, continue to have great news on COVID-19, and joining me to talk about it, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital. Good morning, Dr. Schreiner. Great to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Let's start, first of all, with the continued good news. And how is Huntington Hospital looking with its COVID-19 patients? Do you still have some who are being treated?
We have had a couple of days. I don't know the status this morning, but of no patients with COVID in the hospital, which is just terrific.
Wow. That must feel incredible to have that, given what you dealt with a few months ago.
It does. I think most of us thought that was never going to happen, but it has. And now we're kind of revisiting a lot of the folks that delayed and put things off while the pandemic was going. So we still have our hands full with lots of sick people, unfortunately, but at least we can deal with them as we did before the pandemic.
All right. Dr. Schreiner, let's talk about Napa County, where the first death of a fully vaccinated person has been recorded. This happened earlier this month. The woman was over the age of 65, had underlying health conditions. She died June 2nd after a prolonged time in the hospital. She had received her Moderna vaccine, had her second dose at least 30 days before testing positive for COVID-19, and she tested positive for the Alpha variant, which was first found in the UK. This extraordinarily rare, of course, it's rare to even test positive for COVID-19 after being fully vaccinated, but it shows that, of course, nothing is completely foolproof.
That's right, Larry. And we do know now that some people don't respond to the vaccine. Now, it's been well recognized that in patients with certain types of hematologic cancers like CLL, That they may have a very poor response to any vaccine, but including these. Sometimes people that are taking medications, if they've had an organ transplant, the medications, the immunosuppressive medications, alter their ability to respond to the vaccine. And so most of these individuals who become very sick and unfortunately pass away, and there have been about 500 to 600 cases in the United States of that situation, it's due to underlying illnesses and or medications that they take that do not elicit a good response. However, even in the general population, there can be individuals who, for one reason or another, don't respond to vaccines. We've known that for many, many years. It certainly happens in the setting of influenza, hepatitis B. Sometimes people just don't respond. And so, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's what happens. And then if they're exposed to this highly infectious virus, they can have a bad outcome for both the fact that they didn't respond to the vaccine and also that they have these underlying conditions that increase their mortality.
Still, I mean, it's terrific to see that the breakthrough infection rate is between 0.03 and 0.04%, showing the tremendous effectiveness of the vaccines.
Yes, it's very, very rare for that to happen. You know, it certainly happens much more frequently with influenza. These vaccines are extremely effective, and so, well, I think everybody anticipated that we would see this. It just speaks to the fact that we still have to be very cautious. That you may not know whether or not you responded to the vaccine, and so it's important to be prudent in making choices. And exposing yourself to the virus.
For those of us that had some kind of response, some sort of symptoms after the first or second injection, which is probably most people, is that a good clear indicator that there has been an immune response? Not to say that those who didn't have that didn't have an immune response.
Well, it's not a reliable one for that reason, Larry. Many people, I didn't have particularly a big response. The second vaccine, I felt kind of lethargic, but I was working very hard, so I don't know if that was due to that. But so it's a little unreliable. You know, certainly people that got sick and had a fever and so forth, that is your immune system responding. Whether that means you're going to have adequate amount of antibodies and or cellular and cells to protect you, we don't know. So that's not a very good correlation. You can't count on that. And many, many people don't have any reaction at all, and I don't want them to think that they didn't respond because they had a perfectly normal response.
I also want to talk about comparative risk because I think, you know, we've all been so geared up over the past nearly 16 months to do everything we can to keep ourselves safe from COVID-19, and it's kind of hard to turn that self-protective frame of mind off. And important to keep in mind, you mentioned the flu, that, you know, every year the flu kills tens of thousands of people, typically older, typically people who do have some kind of underlying condition. But flu is a killer. And, you know, important for us to keep in mind that we didn't go through previous years fearful all year that we were going to die of the flu, even though tens of thousands of people typically did.
Well, and I think this is a very different scenario. This is a global pandemic that just really has knocked the world for a real, and it's just been an incredible experience, and I think, and a very tragic one, and it's not over yet. And I think that the magnitude of this pandemic, I think, has been pretty impressive. And so I think that it's different than influenza. You know, influenza is something we all know about. We've all maybe had the flu, and the vast majority of people feel terrible, but they recover. And so I think that was sort of the context. This virus is very, very different. And so although I think we are going to have to take some baby steps in the right direction and kind of open things up, it's difficult to kind of shake off the anxiety that all of us have felt and seen with what's happened over this last year. So I think it's going to be a slow process. I hope that the good things that come out of it are that we pay attention to pathogens and how we acquire them, and to surveil the world very carefully to make sure we don't see other emerging viruses and prepare for them better, and really put some good support into our public health healthcare systems to be able to respond to things like this, because this will not be the last thing.
You know, it's funny how, you know, for each of us, we have different thresholds of comfort or not. But yeah, I have to say, I've only eaten indoor at a restaurant a couple of times since the start of the pandemic. It still feels very odd to be indoors and not wearing a mask while eating. And I know there are other people who have, you know, a higher degree of sensitivity, and others who now are not thinking anything about it, have adjusted very quickly. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Wonderful to have Dr. Schreiner back with us again today, part of our core of medical experts who've been invaluable to us on Air Talk. Dr. Schreiner, we have millions of doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine that are running the risk of expiring without having an arm to be injected into. Part of this, I understand, because of the pause on the J&J while it was being looked into. And so the number of doses backed up while that assessment of the rare blood clot risk was being carried out. How are they going to go about trying to make sure that those doses are actually given?
Well, I think that, you know, they certainly try to encourage areas where people can just have one shot. That's the huge advantage with the J&J vaccine. It's a highly effective vaccine and really very, very safe. It does have this one very significant pause that you have to take when it comes to using it in premenopausal women or people that are predisposed to blood clots. But that being said, it's a very, very effective vaccine. And if it were the only vaccine that was available, you know, certainly everybody would be taking it because it would protect us from this very nasty virus. It's important that they address areas where, again, giving one shot will kind of get everything one and done. So perhaps in some of the rural areas where they can have drive-up clinics, people can get the shot, get out of there. They don't have to come back for a second one. Or, if possible, to get those vaccines overseas to our neighbors in Mexico and South America, to sub-Saharan Africa, to India, where they're in desperate need of vaccinating large numbers of people. So I hope that, I know the Biden administration is really trying to begin to accelerate export of these vaccines and then facilitate COVAX, the WHO organization, for global vaccination, which we have to do to get this pandemic to end. So hopefully it won't be wasted.
Well, and it would be great. You mentioned Mexico because of close proximity. I don't know what the degree of vaccine distribution has been there. Do you know, Dr. Schreiner, is that a country where there's great need for additional doses?
There is great need. I think that obviously in urban areas such as Mexico City, Mexico has some very fine hospitals, and I think that they've been trying to really ramp up their vaccine rate. But it's still it's a very diverse population, lots of areas and pockets of unvaccinated individuals, and they've had a big problem with COVID. So, again, I think that's logical sense. You know, Canada's had some issues. They had a big outbreak up in Manitoba recently.
Yeah. Dr. Schreiner, we'll hear from her as we continue in just a moment. We're taking your questions about COVID-19 and vaccination at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Coming up next hour, we'll take a look at Venice, where homelessness continues to be a serious problem.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for your financial support for Air Talk on KPCC. Christine in Long Beach has a question for Dr. Schreiner. She has CLL, or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which Dr. Schreiner just mentioned. Christine says, I've been fully vaccinated, but we don't know if it really is effective. Will things ever be back to normal for people like me where we can go out safely in the world? Dr. Schreiner?
Well, one thing Christine could do, and this is actually not recommended by the CDC, and I'm not quite sure why they sort of made that comment, because you know the immune system is very complicated, and so we don't know the absence of antibody, measurable antibodies, does that correlate with the absence of response? But certainly that is a concern in somebody with this kind of underlying medical condition. So for Christine, it might be prudent for your physician to check antibody levels, because if you do have antibodies, then that might give you some measure of comfort that, you have some protection. Not everybody with CLL is a non-responder. But I think in an abundance of caution, it's a good idea for her to continue to practice good measures with interacting with people. Stay with, you know, vaccinated people are unlikely to be transmitting the virus. The biggest concern would be, you know, with people that she doesn't know their vaccine status or who are unvaccinated. So that's kind of the best recommendation I could make for right now.
Okay. And if she goes to the supermarket, places like that, where people are still required to be masked and they're not spending an extended period with each other, is that still a generally safe activity for her?
It's a safe activity as long as she's masked. I think really for a while we really need to have a lot of overlap with our masking choices. And regardless of what CDC says, this really is now up to the individual to kind of do a risk assessment and decide where they want to take their mask off. The supermarket may not be that place because you don't have much control over who else might be in there. So,
Mariana in Santa Monica said, my mom has multiple myeloma. She's been vaccinated, but I've been hearing that that might not provide her with a high degree of protection. I'm fully vaccinated, but I'm concerned that I need to be extra careful around my mother. Are there specific precautions that I should and can take when I'm with her?
Well, for multiple myeloma, we have a concern about that responding as well. And again, it might be possible for her to have her mom's antibodies measured. Again, CDC and FDA have sort of poo-pooed that and aren't necessarily recommending it. I don't think that it's a harmful thing. And if you do have antibodies, it gives you some measure of comfort. But again, same thing for her mom is when she's around vaccinated, fully vaccinated, healthy people, the likelihood they're going to transmit the disease is very small. But if she's in an area where you don't know the status of the other people or people who are unvaccinated, that's where there's some risk and her mom should be wearing a mask.
So it sounds like Mariana with her mom, minimal risk because both are fully vaccinated, even with her mom's potentially depressed response. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist with us. As travel begins to open up again, the EU is not accepting people who were vaccinated with vaccines produced in Russia. What's the difference between the vaccines that have been approved for use in the U.S. and in the EU versus those like Russia and other parts of Europe that have not been approved?
Well, so the Sputnik V, which is the Russian vaccine, is very similar to the AstraZeneca vaccine, and there actually are studies that show that it's quite effective, but perhaps not on the same level that the mRNA vaccines or the AstraZeneca Johnson & Johnson vaccines are. There's been some concern that it may not hold up well with some of the variants that are out there, but it actually doesn't look too bad. And it's being used quite a bit in places like India and so forth. The UK has decided that they want to stick with the known commodities, the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and hopefully soon CureVac, which is one of the new mRNA vaccines, seem to be much more robust with the variants. And, of course, they have had some problems with variants in England with both the Alpha variant, the formerly B117, and now the Delta variant, the India one.
All right. So it sounds like it's less about the efficacy. Maybe this is more of a political issue?
I don't know. That could be. But the truth is, you have to go with science. This pandemic has been really very complicated by a lot of political things. And there are some data that suggests Sputnik V is a fairly decent vaccine, even though it wasn't tried very well. The phase 3 trials in Russia were very small before they approved it. Some of the efficacy of some of the Chinese vaccines have been a little bit in question. The CanSino and Sinovac have been a little less robust. Those are all adenovirus-based vaccines. Again, it's just showing the strength of the mRNA vaccines, so that's probably why a lot of these countries would prefer those being the ones you get.
All right. Let's talk with Diamond in West Hollywood. You're on Air Talk with Dr. Schreiner.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Schreiner. I've been really careful this past year, and haven't really seen my boyfriend for more than a few minutes, in very safe circumstances. And I'm just wondering, is it safe if you're vaccinated to actually be intimate with, someone you're close to for now?
If your partner is vaccinated as well, then yes, that's a fairly safe interaction. This virus is a droplet in aerosolized transmitted pathogen. So, if your partner is unvaccinated and you're protected, then that's also reasonably safe for you and perhaps also for that person. But it's the safest would be if both of you are vaccinated. If the person is unvaccinated, there's always a little bit of a risk that they might have COVID and could give it to you. Remember, people that are vaccinated can get COVID. So there's some risk there. Two vaccinated people, it's minimal risk.
All right, Diamond, thanks very much. It'd be nice for you to be able to spend some more time with your boyfriend. KPCC news producer Pablo Cabrera says, I have a cousin coming from Peru where COVID has been a very serious problem. How risky is it to have him with us? We're all fully vaccinated in Pablo's household. He is not vaccinated. He wants to get vaccinated here. So for Pablo's family, they're all vaccinated. Would it be okay for them to have Pablo's unvaccinated cousin from Peru stay with them?
Well, the risk is not zero. If they're all vaccinated and fully protected, then the risk for them acquiring COVID from him is very small. It probably would be prudent, if not mandated by LA County, depending on where Pablo lives, that he be in a quarantine for at least 5 days and then get tested. And if his test is negative, then that increases the risk decreases the risk that he would be transmitting COVID. And then if Pablo wants to get a vaccine, it's free. You can go to any place and get one. And perhaps if he's only here for a short time, he might want to get the J&J vaccine. That's one more person on the planet that's been vaccinated. So when he comes, wait 3 to 5 days, get a nasal swab. If that's a PCR test, if that's negative, then he's it's probably quite safe, especially if he sticks to staying around people that are vaccinated. He should not encounter unvaccinated individuals because he still could possibly be infected and spread the virus. And then he should get vaccinated as soon as possible if he's here.
And Pablo's cousin from Peru can get vaccinated here, though, because I wasn't sure if you can get a vaccine if you live abroad.
I think you can, Larry. It's free.
Right.
You know, it's no questions asked, and it's just, you know.
Yeah.
And he could use his Pablo's address, so I think that's
great.
I hope I'm not in the speaking, but I don't think people, I know at our place, we're sort of like, let's get in here and get a jab in the arm.
Yeah, not turning people away. That's great to hear. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner with us from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Dave in Los Angeles says, I was at the LA County Public Library. Now that it's open, I was surprised to see they're still wiping down surfaces like tables. Wasn't there a consensus among scientists that one isn't getting COVID-19 from surface contact?
That's right. COVID is unlikely to be spread through that modality. However, influenza and rhinoviruses and other viruses can be spread that way. And so I'm not at all going to object to keeping surfaces clean in public places. I think that it's important that we try to control the other viruses that are going to kind of increase as people take their masks off and interact with one another. And of course, now when somebody has a sore throat and a fever, even though they may only have rhinovirus, they're going to have to get a COVID test to make sure they don't have COVID. So it's going to be a little bit of testing problems here as people get common colds and influenza. So wiping the surface down, I don't have any objection to that.
Yeah, that's something I hope Dr. Schreiner actually lasts, because for the very reasons you state, it'd be very nice just to have a higher degree of hygiene on surfaces. Luke in Hollywood says, what about the Vaxart pill form of vaccine? I read more people would become vaccinated if they could take a pill, and preliminary data suggests the pill is effective against numerous variants of COVID. Why aren't we hearing more about it? Could it be used as a booster?
I don't know too much about that particular modality. We do occasionally use oral medications for vaccines. Typhoid fever is a good example of that. That's a live vaccine. This and that modality is being looked at. The studies are not in yet, so there really isn't enough information to test its robustness. And so that's why it's not been approved. You know, it's a very complex course to get these vaccines approved in the United States. Think of what all three of them have done. Over 100,000 people were enrolled in these trials, and were very, very closely studied, and as it should be, but also it helps render the degree of calmness and reassurance to the public that these vaccines have been well studied.
Yeah, it would help with people with, phobia about needles, certainly. But, you know, as you say, we had preliminary data that came out, you know, very early about certain medications or vaccines, and then doesn't hold up when you do it with a larger number of people in the trial. Thank you so much, Dr. Schreiner. It's wonderful to have you with us again today.
It's always my pleasure, Larry.
Thank you. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, providing her expertise to listeners all over Southern California. This has, of course, been a staple for us right here on Air Talk on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German-Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
A new report is looking at the amount of trees lost in Sequoia and in the national park system here in the United States. According to the Visalia Times Delta newspaper, obtained a copy of a report that describes catastrophic destruction from the Castle Fire, which charred 273 square miles of timber in Sequoia National Park. Joining us is the lead author of the new report, Christy Brigham, who's Chief of Resources Management and Science at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Christy, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it very much. Detail for us, please, how this survey of the Sequoias was conducted.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me to talk about this important initial estimate. This report is the combined effort of USGS scientists, Forest Service scientists, National Park Service scientists, and Save the Redwoods League scientists. Myself and Dr. Nathan Stevenson at USGS pulled data from the fire itself, satellite data indicating how much area that had sequoia groves had burned at high severity. And then we used some other field estimates from previous fires to combine those two to estimate how many large sequoias over 4 feet in diameter we think were burned up in this fire.
Now, we tend to think of sequoias, like their cousin redwoods, to be pretty strong, pretty resilient when it comes to fire. What was it about the Castle Fire that made it particularly destructive to the sequoias?
Larry, that's such a good point, and you're exactly right, and that's one of the most startling aspects of this result, is that these trees are incredibly fire resistant. They're adapted to fire. They rely on low severity fire. Never before has a fire killed this many trees. And unfortunately, the conditions that led to the Castle Fire still exist for many of our other groves. And those three conditions are 100 years of fire suppression that has led to a more dense forest, combined with our 2012 through 2016 climate change-driven hotter drought that killed a lot of those trees and made them into fuels. And then you combine that with continuing drought and extreme weather, high winds, and it's a recipe for disaster. And it was a disaster, and those conditions are still threatening so many of our remaining old growth this fire season.
You were mentioning about climate and the effects on drying out the forest. Also, these huge trees are a big factor in cleansing the environment, right?
They are. They're so critical. We love them for so many reasons. They're so charismatic with their shaggy bark and their funny, quirky broccoli tops. And the fact that they're 2,000 years old makes us feel humbled. But they also provide so many ecosystem benefits. They take a lot of carbon out of the air. They produce oxygen. They hold the soil in place. They store water. They store snow. They're an amazing provider of ecosystem services.
So this 10 to 14% loss of the mature giant sequoias and how long it takes for sequoias to grow, I mean, how long would it take to replenish the population at the rate of growth?
Yeah. Oh, Larry, that's such a heartbreaking question. So we, as you said, we estimate based on this satellite data, and we're in the field right now trying to verify those numbers, that we may have lost 10 to 14% of the entire natural population of giant sequoias over 4 feet in diameter. Now, in that size class, some of those trees are 2,000 to 3,000 years old. And it takes 600 to 800 years to get back a tree that size. Now, some of them were probably younger, maybe only 200 years old, which for lots of trees, that's pretty darn old. But for a sequoia, that's young. So when we look at this loss, we consider it irreplaceable within our lifetimes and something that will be, those groves will be recovering for generations.
Given that we've not seen these thousands of year old trees lost in fires previously, Does this argue, in your view, for a more proactive approach to clearing the forests or doing controlled burns to try and cut the severity of fires?
Exactly. You're exactly right, Larry. You clearly know this issue. To me, it is a call to action, an incredibly high level of urgency to look at every tool in the toolbox to do this restoration thinning, to return the forest to a fire resilient state, as it should be. We know we're going to get more wildfires. This is California. We have a lot of lightning. We have a lot of people. We used to have great tribal burning, native steward burning. So we need to break out every tool in the toolbox and work together as forest managers across the board to address this call to action and do thin these fuels out of the forest and bring back fire resilient forests.
We're talking with Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks Chief of Resource Management and Science, Christy Brigham. She's the lead author of this new report that has been prepared to detail the loss of giant mature sequoias in the two parks, Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Parks. And this, I think, was a shock to so many people, given the resiliency of these trees historically, to see that between 10 and 14% are estimated to have been lost. And those are of the mature trees. These are the ones with the larger trunks that she was describing, minimum 4 feet diameter. If you have questions for her about the study, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Christy, are visitors to the parks going to see very clearly this loss, or do you have to really get into the backcountry, where you did the aerial observation to see the degree of loss?
Yeah, that's a great question, Larry. And just a quick clarification, this estimate is over the whole area that burned, which included Park Service, Forest Service, state lands, so a whole mix of, it's not just on the national park, this devastating loss.
Okay.
And
good
that
to
relates to your question. So if you are a fan of Freeman Creek Grove, which is a fairly easy grove to access on the forest, or if you've been to Alder Creek Grove, which is a Save the Redwoods property, in those areas, you visitors will see the devastation. Most of our visitors to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, they won't see them because our groves are pretty far into the wilderness, and most of the severely burned groves don't even have trails to them. So it is a little bit of a hidden loss, which is one of the many reasons why I so appreciate yours and others' coverage of this story.
Well, Christy, I want to say on behalf of our listeners, we appreciate you and your colleagues so much. And I know you are just going to be inundated with visitors this summer because so many people have pent up energy and want to get outdoors and are going to be heavily using our national parks. And thanks to you and all your colleagues for the tremendous commitment that you have to the work that you do, to educating those of us in the public that need to learn more about these extraordinary spaces that we have and historic places here in California and elsewhere in the country. So thank you very much for what you do.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you for what you do. I love your show.
Oh, thanks so much. Christy Brigham, she's Chief of Resources Management and Science at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park. She's the lead author of this survey looking at the extensive destruction of the Castle Fire on the giant groves of sequoias right here in California. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. I hope you'll join me coming up later this month. I'm a huge fan of the Prime Video series Bosch, based on Michael Connelly's character who makes an appearance in so many books. You know, as I mentioned on the program a number of times, my grandfather, Arnold Hupka, essentially was Bosch. He was Hollywood LAPD homicide detective in the 1940s and 50s. Very same position that the fictional Harry Bosch has on the television series and in Michael Connelly's books. And I was very excited to be approached by Bosch to have a very small role in this upcoming final season. My voice you will hear at a very key point throughout the course of this upcoming season. And to celebrate Bosch, the final season of the Prime Video series, we are doing an AirTalk virtual event Monday night, June 26th at 6 o'clock. We'll be joined by Michael Connelly, by Bosch himself, Titus Welliver, and many other members of the cast who are going to be joining us to talk about their roles in this series. So it's a virtual event coming into your home Monday night, June 21st, 6 p.m., RSVP at kpecc.org/in-person. We're talking Bosch for a full hour plus. We hope that you can join us to do so. I'm joined now by Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez, who's been writing about the homelessness crisis in Venice and all the tremendous challenges that local officials have been dealing with, residents of Venice, and of course, those living on the boardwalk and in surrounding areas of Venice. Steve, it's so good to have you with us again. I understand you used to live in Venice. Your most recent column is about the crisis there. What's changed?
First, I have to say, Larry, that I'm really envious. I've always wanted to be on Bosch.
You should be on Bosch.
And I even talked to, her name is escaping me, but I know the woman who plays the detective. And she said, hey, come on by the set. Did you know that...
Amy Aquino, you're probably talking about.
Michael? Michael was walking through the squad room, Michael Connelly?
No, I didn't see that.
Yes, I spotted him and I emailed him. I said, was that you? And he said, yes, it was. I'm sorry, okay.
No, that's all right. That's all right.
I lived near the Venice-Santa Monica border in, it was the late 90s. And it was six, seven blocks from the beach. And I would walk down there. I mean, I would take the big blue bus to work. I worked for Time Magazine and the LA Bureau, and when I got home, I would walk or ride my bike down to the beach. And come on, you know, you've been here, you're a native, and you know that Venice has always been kind of funky and artsy and at times a little bit sketchy. And that's been part of its appeal, not just for Angelenos, but for people from all over the world. But it has changed, and there are two things. I think one is the gentrification. And the other is, of course, that it's become one of the epicenters of social collapse. And, I mean, it used to be primarily Skid Row, and then Venice developed its own challenges, and Hollywood. I think of those places. Homelessness is everywhere, of course. But I think of Venice now as a kind of a focal point and an interesting consideration for mayoral candidates, which I guess is why Joe Buscaino showed up there yesterday morning to say something about addressing homelessness in ways that it has not yet been addressed. But it clearly is a bit out of control. That's partly because the hands are tied, the hands of public officials legally, because of CDC recommendations during the pandemic. It's partly because of the Jones-Boise case, and you can't remove somebody if you don't have a place to take them. But it's reached a point where a lot of residents are tired and either out of a sense of frustration or compassion for the many people who are suffering on the streets and on the boardwalk. They want to see this change.
You know, I was talking about the population change and gentrification. My family goes way back. My great-grandfather bought a lot on one of the canals and built a couple of little shacks and actually moved in and lived there full-time. It's supposed to be a weekend place, but so they could afford to send my grandfather to medical school. And so they rented out their house in South L.A. and lived in these two little shacks on the canal. Now, of course, there's a huge mansion that's on that. Things have changed dramatically, but... I took my great uncle, who recently passed at 99, out there. He couldn't believe how different it looked from his boyhood. But this area has gone through a lot of shifts over the years. But it seems at this point, city officials, Steve, are just completely flummoxed and don't know where to turn. There's resistance to shelters being created in Venice to house people that are homeless. And it seems like the LAPD is very reluctant or feels that it can't step in and remove people.
Right, and here you have Joe Buscaino, who is a former police officer, appearing there yesterday with Sheriff Villanueva and pushing a, come on, we've got to reclaim our streets. And, you know, if it takes police presence to do that, then let's do it. And on the other end, you have people like Mike Bonin. And I did meet with Mike, the councilman representing that district, yesterday. We had a long sit-down. And by the way, we had it on Washington Boulevard in a former Ramada Hotel. And I think Mike wanted to meet there because it's going to become a project home key. Room key was a somewhat different operation. With home key, the city using state money is buying hotels, and they bought that one. It's a 37-unit former Ramada, and they're going to be moving people in as soon as in a few weeks. So, you know, Mike's approach has been to do things like that, incrementally address the need, and supportive housing. And he, of course, was the one who really promoted the idea of the bridge housing in Venice that a lot of residents said, no, 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 no. If you put bridge housing here, it attracts more people. It's going to make the situation worse and not better. And it turns out, I mean, depending on who you talk to, they may have been right. But when I asked Bonin about this yesterday, I said, you know, they warned you that this was going to make it worse. And he said, yes, but it happened at the beginning of the pandemic. And we were not able to link the people with the services that should have been a part of that program had we not been dealing with the restrictions from COVID. So he's hoping to get that in better shape. But in Venice and throughout LA, you've got to give public officials credit for doing an awful lot. I think they deserve credit. I don't know of any city or county that has done more. The problem is that it has not been up to the needed scale. And, you know, you provide 1,000 new housing units and 2,000 more people are waiting in line. So those are some big, big issues. And they are going to be, I think, at the center of the mayoral debate. And we're going to be listening very closely, whether it's Kevin De Leon or it's Mark Ridley Thomas or it's Nuri Martinez or it's Joe Buscaino or maybe Rick Caruso jumps in. I don't know. He's always thinking about it. But this is something that I think my sense from hearing from readers on a regular basis is they're tired of the discussion. They're ready to get behind somebody who has what look like workable solutions that can lead to a noticeable difference on the streets sooner rather than later.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times longtime columnist Steve Lopez, writing recently about a Venice couple whose condo's right on the oceanfront, the boardwalk there, and about how they essentially feel prisoners in their own homes. They're very supportive of the people that are living on the beach. They don't blame them, but they're very critical of public officials over how they've handled the growing crisis of homelessness. And Steve, you had yet another violent incident Sunday night, or Sunday afternoon, I should say, where a street performer in his 70s was, you know, punched out and suffered cuts to his face on the boardwalk. You know, what appeared to be a completely unprovoked attack. It seems like we just hear about these sorts of things all the time now in Venice.
Yeah, those videos are flying around the internet. I get them regularly, muggings, beatings. I hope that we don't get distracted by that. I really do, and that's a point that Bonin made yesterday. I hope that we don't end up sensationalizing this. I think that the conversation has to be about what works, what we know has worked, what we need more of, and let's get to it. And as frustrated as Angelinos are, and even I am, on a personal note, Larry, right before you called, I got a call from my buddy Nathaniel. Nathaniel is the subject of my book, The Soloist, and there was a movie based on the book. And it took 1 year of efforts by me and LAMP Community, which is now part of the People Concern, professional outreach mental health people, to get Nathaniel to agree to consider moving indoors. It took a long, long time, and it's taken 16 years since then of managing him and helping him maintain some equilibrium. So I do know that although people are impatient with those on the streets who are dealing with a severe mental illness, and often it's complicated by an addiction, this takes time. You just do what Molly Lowry the legendary outreach worker used to call, do whatever it takes for as long as it takes and have some consistency.
Yeah, Steve, thank you so much. And as you're saying, magnify Nathaniel's circumstances, you know, tens of thousands of times, and the amount of persistence and support that's required to change a life that's in crisis. Steve Lopez joining us, Los Angeles Times columnist with us on Air Talk.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
As of this week, music producer and YouTube star Rick Beato has 2.3 million subscribers who watch his deep dives into musical theater, often using examples from pop music. His videos are meant to be educational. They're deeply analytical, but they are from time to time demonetized for copyright infringement. That means a protest is filed by the owner of the publishing rights of the song that he's highlighting. Most recently, Beato had a dispute with music publisher Warner Chappell Music over a live streamed video called Why Today's Music Is So Boring, The Regression of Musical Innovation. He played a chord progression on his guitar of Led Zeppelin's Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You as an example of a complex chord progression.
We'll take any Led Zeppelin song, Stairway to Heaven, or Babe, I'm gonna leave you. I'm using a million things then. Experimenting all over the place, right, with these different chord progressions.
That Rick Beato in his YouTube video, Why Today's Music Is So Boring, The Regression of Musical Innovation. This morning, Beato says he got word that the claim was released from Warner Chappell Music. With us to talk about the legal issues that play out here, because Beato is not alone with having this same sort of copyright issue with music, is Kelly Shapiro, a managing partner and founder of the Los Angeles-based firm, Kelly D. Shapiro. Kelly, thank you very much for being with us. This, of course, we're in a whole new generation of these kinds of conflicts with YouTube and Twitch and all sorts of other uses of music like this. How common is it for a publishing company like this to go after the content?
Hi, Larry. Pleasure to be here. You know, we're starting to see a trend where copyright infringement cases or basically takedown notices, DMCA takedown notices, are increasing year by year. It's increased every year, especially within the last few years. And publishers are looking to protect their assets, right? They're in the business of making money, not in the business of education, which was the video that you just played, right? So they are definitely going to enforce their legal protections into the work that they own. or even partially owned, that they administer the rights for. So it definitely happens quite a bit, and I represent artists. I'm on the artist side. And so we see this a lot, especially my, DJ clients or anything like that, but also my individual artist clients also on the other side of that, they themselves will, through me, will send DMCA takedown notices, not just on YouTube, TikTok also, we've had to do that as well to protect the rights of the owners of the copyright.
Why in this case, though, wouldn't the publisher see Beato's instructional videos, the educational component of it, and that it probably is going to drive people to listen to the original Led Zeppelin song, that this is a benefit for the publisher?
That's what I would think. However, I think their first, their first instinct is to protect, and to quiet down any potential infringers. And they also know they have the leverage there because, yeah, you can fight back, but it's going to cost you, right, to actually go because YouTube is not the court of law, right? They have their own process of addressing potential infringements of copyright. But you would really have to fight it out. YouTube doesn't want to be in that business. You have to fight it out in actual court. So the big publishers obviously have the time and the resources to try and defend their interests. And so, unfortunately, these creators, I think it was clear and clearly because just recently that claim was released, hopefully they came to their senses that, oh, this is actually, this would come under the educational fair use doctrine, and then they realize the error of their ways. But I think they want to send a message to creators, say, we are watching you. You better make sure you are legally prepared to defend your use of this copyrighted work, or we will make it difficult for you to stay, to keep your channels up and to keep continuing to monetize your channel.
Given that Beato was DMCA'd for playing a chord progression, then what does this mean for, song cover videos where people are performing someone else's song? And then can the publishing company go after people for doing that?
Unfortunately, they can go after quite a bit of folks. They have quite a long leeway, or there's a way for, I strongly suggest that creators, before uploading content, they really go through the fair use doctrine. There's a 4-part test, and specifically with covers and with fair use, I would think that if they're adding anything to the song, also that's one thing. But you just covering the song, I would just be very careful because you can get a license. That's always the safest way, right? For folks to get a license from the copyright holder to post their cover. But you really have to look because it's a case by case situation. For every single video, every single bit of content.
Yeah.
I really don't want to say a blanket answer that shows
sure.
doing covers, but you really have to look into this, and it's really, really case by case. And I'd really encourage creators to really research what that 4-part test is of the fair use doctrine of copyright law to make sure they're protected.
Kelly Shapiro, Santa Monica and LA-based attorney with her own firm. Also with us is adjunct professor of business and music law at UCLA, Don Franzen. He's visiting professor at the Berklee School of Music as well, and his firm is based in Beverly Hills. Don, thank you very much for being with us. Let's flesh out a bit. What is that 4-part test for fair use?
Yeah, happy to do so. And thank you, Larry, for the chance to talk about this. I agree with everything Ms. Shapiro just said, but to follow up on what she mentioned, yeah, the fair use test is unfortunately not a bright line test. It is a test that involves 4 different factors. And in a statute, it's in Section 107 of the Copyright Code. What it requires is the court has to look at 4 things. One is the nature and purpose of the use, and the fact that it's educational or nonprofit weighs very heavily here. The other factor is the weight given to the copyright of the underlying work, the work that is owned by the party that's complaining. And then the amount of the work and the substantiality that's taken. And then last factor is the effect on the market for the underlying work. And when I analyze this, and I imagine, I don't know if Ms. Shapiro came to the same conclusion, but I see Mr. Beato winning on 3 out of 4. I really think this was a fair use situation because it was for educational purposes. The only thing that counts against him is that he is a commercial for-profit blogger, but the Supreme Court made clear years ago in the Pretty Woman case that just the fact you're commercial doesn't mean you're not fair use. It doesn't exclude you from invoking fair use. And the other factors, the work, the underlying work, of course, is protected, although we could argue about whether this particular chord progression, the 5 chords that he played, actually are protected. We could argue about that. But in terms of what he took, he only took enough to make his pedagogical point. He took enough to illustrate the point he's trying to make, which is that this was a more complex chord progression, and he was contrasting it to what he considers less complex and less interesting chord progressions done by contemporary artists. And then the effect on the market you alluded to, which it might be that someone will go listen to the Led Zeppelin song now because they found this so interesting, his exposition on the chord progression. So anyway, that's my scorecard. I give him 3 out of 4 in his favor, and I think it was very wise on the publisher's part, on Warner Chappell's part, to pull back the claim.
In terms of the market effect, if Beato had been ridiculing the song and playing that chord progression to show that it's overly simplistic, let's say he was doing the exact opposite of what he was doing, would that have made it easier for the publisher to make their case?
Well, then the doctrine of parody comes in, which I mentioned a moment ago, the Pretty Woman case, where the Two Live Crew did a parody of Roy Orbison's iconic song, Pretty Woman. And the Supreme Court in that case, this goes back a couple decades now, did say that parody can be a form of fair use. And then you apply the same 4-factor test that I just went through. So if he was doing it to the purpose of making a parody of or possibly ridiculing the original song, he might still be protected.
All right. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. That's Don Franzen, music and entertainment attorney based in Beverly Hills. He also teaches business and music law at UCLA and is a visiting professor at the Berklee School of Music. And my thanks to attorney Kelly Shapiro, who provides representation to very high-profile DJs, musicians, singer-songwriters, stand-up comics, actors, and much more. It's Air Talk on KPCC. This week, and almost certainly with our member drives to come, we're going to take a few minutes so that you can hear from the absolutely essential KPCC employees who allow this service to be able to do what it does. They are every bit as important as those in what's called the content side. These are folks I've worked with in many cases for years and are absolutely invaluable. Joining us today is Jen Boffman, who's our traffic manager. We'll explain what that means in a moment. And Gordon Henderson, whose voice you hear regularly with the KPCC underwriting and promotional spots on our air. He's a production specialist who puts those together as well as voices many of them. Jen and Gordon, very good to have you with us today. Jen, first describe for us what is a traffic manager in radio?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for this opportunity. Yeah, a traffic manager is someone who, to put it simply, puts together what we call a daily log. It's basically a script of the full 24 hours of what you hear on air. And to do that, we work with many, many teams throughout the building, underwriting, programming, our in-person events team, LAist and LAist Studios, and development. And we work with Gordon to produce spots and schedule them.
And so you'll be checking in with different departments, like sometimes with Air Talk. Are you guys going to be on or off for this holiday? Are you going to have a promo that runs for the next? So all those sorts of coordination thing that you're doing all across all the different programs, national and local.
Yeah, it's basically like putting a puzzle together every day, and it's a similar puzzle, but it's different every day.
And so then this is followed by the engineers. That log is their daily Bible, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah, the engineers are able to follow that and know when to run certain promos and underwriting spots. And we work together to make sure that everything runs as it should.
And explain some of the challenges. Like, for example, I know you try and avoid having a spot that I record with my voice coming out of me talking live, for example. But what are some other examples of some of the things you have to determine for scheduling?
Yeah, we have to think about whose voice to spot, what it's promoting. We don't want an underwriter, say, for a movie that is being talked about on Film Week. We don't want those things crossing lines. So we have to think about all those things. And it's a lot of spinning plates, and it takes a lot of attention to detail. And I'm really lucky to have a team of people. It's myself, and I have two fantastic traffic associates, Micah Kielbon and Louis Rinkavich, who also help to get these logs out every day, because it's a big lift.
Yeah, no question. It's clearly understandable why at least three people are needed to do it. And then you have a software program that assists in the process in which you enter this information?
We do. We use a system called Wide Orbit now, and we just switched over to this system after many, many years. I've been working with KPCC for 13 years, and we were on the same traffic system up until last summer. We just switched over to a new one. It's really robust. It really helps us to look at the big picture and think about all these variables and really be able to move things around in an agile way that hopefully creates a wonderful listener experience.
Jen Boffman with us, KPCC traffic manager. I mentioned Gordon Henderson. You'll recognize his voice right away. Good morning, Gordon.
Hi, Larry.
I get to work with Gordon when there are certain things that I need to record that promote things, and Gordon's the one who sends me the copy that I'm going to be reading, and it goes back to him then for the production touches and the mix before it goes on the air. So, Gordon, describe a little bit as a production specialist what you're looking for when you're creating the particular underwriting message or the particular promotional spot.
Well, for instance, we record, say, the Film Week Oscars promos or other promos for live events that you might be doing, or sometimes you will do promos. I'm always looking for a good, clear sounding and conversational voice when I'm producing someone else. I guess you spoke a little about it, but we produce the announcements that you hear between programming. For instance, when you say we'll be back in 60 seconds, usually that means that you'll hear one of the elements that I worked on.
And in doing that, you're always trying to make it sound fresh and different. How do you make the choices of the music that you use in those spots?
Well, some of it is dictated by what we have the license for. We have a licensing company that we use for anything that we do for underwriting. We can't use commercial music because there'd be a copyright infringement there. So I'm just trying to find things that are sort of neutral and upbeat and will not distract from the voiceover.
And what brought you to public broadcasting, Gordon?
Well, I'm sort of the classic kid who grew up in a family where the parents were listening to NPR. And as I think is sort of tradition, I didn't really want to hear it. I would have rather heard music, a music station.
Yeah.
But I have been a lifelong radio fan. And as soon as I became an adult and was in my own car and everything, I was listening to NPR. And as a kid, I also heard announcers like Ken Nordine, and I really liked it. So I wanted to be an announcer or a narrator when I was young. And I joined KPCC in 2006, but at first I joined as a board operator. But I always wanted to be on air. But I didn't really have what the program director was looking for. I did some spots. But then I started to work with Fred Missman, who was my predecessor in the job I have now. And Fred said, started working with me, and he said, well, why don't you do something? He had a sort of persona for me. He wanted me to be the guy in the orange tie. And his idea of the guy in the orange tie was a pretty much a straightforward-looking person, but there was one element to them that was unusual, and that was the orange tie. And he said, do that with your voice.
That's fascinating. Become direction. That. I love that.
So I did that, and pretty much I've been on air ever since. And then I joined the production department when there was an opportunity. So it's a creative and technical job, which works for my personality.
Which seems perfect. And I should mention, speaking of the orange tie, Gordon is a great dresser. He always has these great shirts that I love every time I see him. He's just a terrific shirt finder. Jen, briefly, how did you come to public radio?
You know, when I was in college, one of our professors offered us extra credit if we volunteered at the college public radio station's pledge drive. So I went in and volunteered at the pledge drive and answered phones and took down people's pledges. And when I moved home, I had a boyfriend that introduced me to the local public radio station down here in Los Angeles. And I've been listening to Los Angeles Public Radio ever since.
All right, Jen. Well, thank you so much. And is there anything you want to say to your KPCC colleagues that we need to do better to help you get your logs out in a timely way? Now's a chance to say it to thousands.
I think I've already told everyone.
Okay.
And we have the best colleagues. Everyone does a great job to really pull together and be a team. And everybody is really considerate of each other. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks. I was ready for a scold, but I appreciate that. What you say, I think, is so true that we are very supportive of each other. And it's a really, really nice place to work when people appreciate what each other does throughout the day. Jen, thank you. I mean, for all these years, you've just been invaluable and a rock for us. I can't thank you enough for what you do here at KPCC. And Gordon, I love hearing you on the air. I love working with you. You're a tremendous colleague, and you are doing something for which you are so gifted and well-suited. So thank you as well. Appreciate it, both of you. Two essential parts of KPCC in the service here. They're part of the backbone of 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org.
The Colorado River is running dry. Water may not reach millions of people.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
It's up to California's lead negotiator, a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
And six other negotiators to find a solution.
I want an agreement that lessens the pain for all of us, not just some of us.
Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water deal maker, wherever you get podcasts.